Hello, everybody. This is Josh Summers. You're listening to Everyday Sublime, a podcast that I host where I try to explore spirituality through the lens of yin yoga, qigong, meditation, modern Eastern psychology models. And I really try to flesh out a full integral approach to spiritual practice and spiritual growth. And in this episode, I'm continuing to reflect on a teaching that I received from my late psychotherapist and mentor and Dharma teacher, Jack Engler. It's the insight or the teaching that Jack had around how insight, real transformative insight, inevitably involves phases of grief or a process of mourning. And I really open that up in the talk here, but one of the experiential practices that I'm emphasizing in this talk is a practice referred to as the practice of non-grasping. How do we both first identify what non-grasping is like vis-a-vis what the experience of grasping is like, and then how does that understanding of what non-grasping is become practiced within our meditation? And to that end, I have included a guided meditation in the show notes of this episode. And this marks a kind of a new feature of what Terry and I are offering each week. So Terry's my life and business partner and practice partner and teaching partner. And she and I are now giving what we're calling a practice etude, a short 15-minute practice around some essential theme of practice. And this week's practice etude focuses on the theme of meditation without grasping. Terry's etudes will tend to be more embodied, involving a qigong practice or a yin yoga-focused practice. Again, 15 minutes or less. These are meant to be small practices that people can do in their daily life that really embody in what we identify as some of the essential components, the essential capacities, developments of practice. So we hope you enjoy these practice etudes, and I just want to say that these etudes, these free weekly offerings, will be available in the podcast feed, but they'll also be available through the newsletter, our bi-weekly newsletter called Practicing Yin. So if you're at all interested in any of that, please consider subscribing to the newsletter. There's a link for you in the show notes. Check out the practice etude. And just know that these free offerings are freely available to you by virtue of the generosity of the members in our practice sangha called the Riverbird Sangha. So this is an international group of yin yoga, qigong, and meditation practitioners. And it's through their ongoing practice with us, their support of our teaching through a sliding scale membership, it really makes these teachings, or gives us the ability to make these teachings available for free. So not everything's for free. We obviously have trainings that we offer and workshops and books and things that we rely on for our own income. But in the spirit of generosity and in the spirit of dana, which is the concept of generosity in Buddhism, we do want to make some of our essential practices and teachings freely available. So the practice etude is serving that intention. And if you enjoy it, please share it with somebody. And if you really enjoy it, please consider supporting our work and supporting your practice by becoming a member of the Riverbird Sangha. Okay, without further ado, here's today's talk, Meditation Without Grasping. And remember, there's a free 15-minute guided meditation on that title, Meditation Without Grasping, in the show notes. Here's the talk. So on that theme, this talk, if I want to pick up the theme of today's talk, every time I sketch out a few notes for a talk, I try in my head to recollect some of the themes we've explored already. And if I were to summarize kind of where we are at this point in our year of practice together. What I recollected was that I remember in the, you know, going back a couple of months, I shared some stories about two women in particular, one from the Buddhist time, one from more living recent history, last century. But I shared two stories about women who experienced tremendous losses in their lives, and it was often the death of a child or the death of a few children, the death of a partner, the loss of physical health, the loss of mental health. They were both incredibly destabilized and kind of unraveled by excruciating loss. And yet, as their stories convey to us, in their lives, they were able to put into practice a kind of medicine. We can call it the Dharma medicine, the Buddha's medicine. We can call it spiritual medicine, heart medicine. But they were able to take on a practice, to pick up a practice, to engage with a practice, to really take in the practice as a kind of medicine. And as a result of that, at least the way it's documented in the stories, they both, and they're just two shining examples, but they both experienced a transformation of consciousness. They both experienced a conversion of perception, a conversion of their sense of self, what they took themselves to be. And with that came a conversion of their entire life experience, that rather than being crushed, by the immense losses that they faced, they were like, in a way, the phoenix that rises from the ashes, and they came out as saints. Saints in the sense of individuals who engaged with the world, once transformed by their practice, they engaged with the world that was described by those that knew them as a way of living that was characterized by an immeasurable compassion, an immeasurable kindness, an immeasurable sense of goodwill and service to others. So I'm just holding these stories up because they kind of, in a way, signify the two poles of spiritual practice, the two endpoints of spiritual practice, beginning in misery and awakening to immeasurable compassion and love and sainthood, in a way. And so as I reflected on that, as I recollected these stories and kind of the trajectory of the practice path that they describe, I kept asking myself, well, what was the catalyst? What was the magic sauce? What was it that allowed them to experience that conversion of being? What allowed them to overcome the great hardship and pain and be reborn, in a sense, with a different way of operating, a different way of engaging, a different way of understanding the experience of the world? So from that question, what facilitated, what catalyzed their conversion of being, their transformation of heart, their transformation of consciousness? And as I held that question throughout the week, you know, this becomes a contemplative question, and I'm using myself as an example for, you know, what I might recommend we all consider exploring is that as we practice, certain questions inevitably come up. And my recommendation, suggestion here is to try to figure out how we can use these questions to kindle our own practice, not just for the 15 minutes or 20 minutes that we formally set aside to put our sit bones on the cushion or the bench or the chair, but to use the question so that it really becomes a lamp that we're, or a torch that we're holding throughout the day, throughout our waking life, so that our daily life is infused with the intentions and the care that we often just reserve for our practice. And in sitting with that question, what allowed their conversion? Last week, I shared from my late teacher, Jack Engler's reflections around the nature of the path, the nature of spiritual awakening. And as he was a Western trained psychologist, deeply practiced with the Eastern tradition of early Buddhism. And after decades of practice, his insight was that path is a path of mourning, not M-O-R-N-I-N-G, like the morning here in Maine, but mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, of grieving. That any insight, sort of the essence of that reflection I shared last week, was that any profound insight that will facilitate a change of consciousness, that will facilitate a change of understanding about who and what we are, any insight inevitably disabuses the person having the insight of an illusion they had. So when reality, when the truth of things flashes before us as an insight of this is the way it is, this is the way it really is, that often shatters some illusion we have about ourselves. And it could be a self-image we have for ourselves in terms of how we limit ourselves and views and opinions that we may have self-created, we may have internalized them from others, we may have internalized them from a society. Or it shatters an illusion around who and what will be in our life for how long. Death does that for sure. The suddenness of death, the irrevocable nature of death. What was there is no longer there. And we, you know, when we confront it, we reel. It's like, how is this possible? But we confront the way things are. And there's, as Jack was trying to say, there's a grieving process in that. And the grieving, it's what I really appreciated about how he said it and emphasized it is that insight alone is not enough to change. We can all have the insight, I need to do something differently, or I need to not do X, or I should do more of Y. Or in this situation, when A is happening, I should do B rather than C. We can all have the intellectual, cognitive understanding of what is the right thing, what we identify ourselves as wanting to do. And we've all had the experience of knowing that and then seeing ourselves not do that, seeing ourselves do something else. And so Jack's point was that, you know, intellectual cognitive insight is not adequate. That the insight needs to be worked through or worked into or awakened into. And that involves a grieving process of letting go of the part of us or the perception within us that tends to keep us in that habituated reactive pattern or that habituated pattern of responding in a way that is often continuing to get us caught. So from that reflection from Jack last week, I was trying to essentialize, as I've received, you know, essentialize what, if I were to try to share what the essence of the path involves, I was drawing on this very famous injunction, this very famous teaching from the Buddha, where he says, nothing whatsoever should be clung to as my or mine or I. So nothing whatsoever. He doesn't say nothing whatsoever except for, you know, your fond memory of your childhood, or except for your fear, or except for the feeling of being conscious. It doesn't matter what it is. He said, nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. And that statement, as you could say, as complete as it is, really needs to be explored and opened up or unpacked, as podcasters tend to say, we're going to unpack this now. But that needs to be unpacked so that we, I think, can work with it in a way, work with that sharp tool, that sharp teaching, in a way that it helps us cut through our illusions without self-harming, like not without using the sharpness of the tool to actually create more difficulty or suffering or problems. Okay, I hope you enjoyed some of those reflections. I hope they offer something for you in your own practice. And just, I want to once again mention that in the show notes, there is a practice etude, which is a guided meditation practice of 15 minutes that focuses on really training the ability to release grasping and to taste directly, to feel directly, to know directly the consequences and the shift in perception that occurs when grasping is released again and again and again. So I hope you enjoy the practice etude. If you like these reflections, if you are interested in supporting your own practice, again, all our teachings are made available by the generosity of the members of the Riverbird Sangha, and we welcome you to join our practice community online of 4 weekly classes over Zoom, hours and hours and hours of recorded classes and tutorials and workshops in our bank of material in our ongoing expanding library in the Sangha, which means if you can't make it live, there's always a recording in the library for you to practice along with. So we're here to support your practice. We really look forward to practicing with you. And until the next episode, stay safe, stay strong, keep practicing, and I look forward to seeing you soon. All my best.